So my name is Anthony Lokakilu, and I'll be giving a bit more details on what George has presented this morning. I'll give more examples, and I'll show you how you've used the machinery that Pablo introduced yesterday and extended his work, and with his help and with the girl's help, with Stephen Prashnak, to systems that have other features that are more interesting, such as constraint systems and hybrid and switching systems to compute the Yapmin functions for them. So the purpose of all these is to create short proofs of stability of nonlinear systems in a way that is novel for these questions, and in the sense that such questions were difficult to answer, but now there is an algorithmic way in which the user needs only to formulate the problem in the correct manner and present it as such that the software is easy, is ready to use and create and construct these proof certificates. So what I want to start talking about is stability and robustability, and introduce a few more notions in what George has presented this morning, and then talk about Lyapunov stability and the Lyapunov functions, and then introduce the sum squares composition as Pablo has used yesterday, so that these three things will form the ingredients of what we'll be talking about later on today, and allow us to compute the Lyapunov functions for systems that are described by polynomial vector fields, or systems that are constrained. They have constraints on equality, inequality, or integral quadratic constraints. I'll stress the role of equality, inequality, and integral quadratic constraints, and show how this new extension allows us to do robustness analysis of nonlinear systems, robustness analysis with parametric uncertainty or with dynamic uncertainty. I'll present the theorem, even though I don't have an example for an IQC. I'll present the theorem how one can do robustness analysis for such constrained systems. And this will allow us also to attack another class of systems that are non-polynomial, that have non-polynomial vector fields, which is another important issue especially for biological systems, because they tend to have rational functions or radical functions that are certainly not polynomial. And then after the break, I'll talk about hybrid switching systems and show how we can construct these Lyapunov-like functions that are only true for certain parts of the state space and are glued along these switching surface to form a global kind of Lyapunov function for the hybrid system that can prove stability and robustability of these systems. So George has introduced the notion of stability of equilibria, the picture that we have in our mind of stability of equilibria is being nearby. If you start near an equilibrium, you stay near an equilibrium, which is very abstract, has been cast into this Lyapunov kind theorem that is a very strong theorem in the sense that it captures all these details about nearness of where you are and where you're going, but it also introduces another difficulty in the sense that it does not provide us with a coherent methodology of constructing these functions. And the first thing I want to say is that I'll always be talking about the equilibrium of a system being at the origin, and this does not mean that I am, this doesn't lose any generality because it can always move the axes of the system where the equilibrium sits on to so that the equilibrium sits at the origin by its simple transformation of coordinates of this form. So here the equilibrium of x dot is f of x sits at x over bar. And if I introduce this change of coordinates on f, then the dynamics of y have the equilibrium at the origin. And this coordinate transformation is general, so I will always assume that the equilibrium of such systems is at the origin. So, and you have been introduced to the notion of Lyapunov function and Lyapunov stability, and what these two conditions are, the two Lyapunov conditions that we have to meet so as to prove a stability of the zero equilibrium of x dot is f of x is. So the first condition is a positivity condition on the Lyapunov function. It has to be positive everywhere, possibly at the origin, and a decrescent condition on the time derivative along the trajectories, which is required so that's to ensure that the level, the you're always moving inside the level curves, inclusive level curves of this Lyapunov function. So as I said in my introduction, the notion of stability that we have in our mind is some notion of starting close and staying close to the equilibrium, and this is captured by if you were to attack this problem in a different manner, you'd have to solve the differential equations and try to get some bounds on these nearness measures. But this Lyapunov theorem allows you to actually attack the problem of uniform stability, this notion of an exponential stability, this notion of stability of the equilibrium, by just constructing a simple function. The question is, the problem with that is that there's no coherent methodology to construct these functions. And what we have in mind, and what Pablo has done in his thesis, one of the things is that he has having introduced the notion of sum of squares, he has applied these to constructing these functions, constructing Lyapunov functions for nonlinear systems. Now, so what I will do in the next few slides, I'll try to go back to his talk yesterday and remind ourselves of what the sum of squares decomposition is, and then we'll bind all these notion of Lyapunov stability with the sum of squares to allow us to construct a very simple Lyapunov function for a nonlinear system. So recall that the sum of squares decomposition is some condition for positivity, as we'll see. We call that a multivariate polynomial p in n variables x1 to xn is a sum of squares if, well, it can be written as a sum of terms that are squared. Now, being able to write such a function as such a polynomial as such, there's a plus missing there, that means that p is obviously positive semi-definite. It is always positive, apart from probably the solution of the system fi is zero, where you might have a manifold upon which the p is zero, or a variety where p is zero. The problem of proving positivity of function is an NP-hard problem when the order of the polynomial is more than 4, and this is what Pablo was talking about yesterday. So the fact that you cannot construct a Lyapunov, you cannot test in an algorithmic way whether a function is positive when the order is at least 4, the sum of squares decomposition can come to the rescue. But the problem is that there is a small there's a gap between the notion of sum of squares and positive semi-definiteness. So the gap is as follows. There is a polynomial that is positive semi-definite, but is not a sum of squares. So if I'm given a polynomial and I'm asked for positivity, right, it's difficult to answer this question because it's NP-hard when the order is less than 4. But you can check whether it's a sum of squares. And it might be, and then you're done with your question. But it is not always true that a positive semi-definite polynomial is a sum of squares. And we're accepting these that we, from now on, we'll be searching for polynomials with the sums of squares. We're doing this concession in the sense that we want a methodology to construct these functions, and faced with the fact that constructing these Lyapunov functions which have these conditions that for positivity, that these are NP-hard problems, then the only way we can attack the problem is by looking at sums of squares. Now, checking whether a function is positive semi-definite is NP-hard. Checking whether a function is a sum of squares or admits a sum of squares composition is worst-case polynomial, and this is the heart of the issues that the testing whether a polynomial is a sum of squares. We can cast it as a certain type of program that can be algorithmically tested. We can cast it as a semi-definite program, which is, if you know about linear programming, that's an extension of linear programming. So if we can cast it as a semi-definite program, which has worst case polynomial time solution. So we can test whether it's a sum of squares in polynomial time. Now, this is a sort of recap of what we were saying yesterday, is that this condition is equivalent to writing it as this form, Z transpose Q Z, where Z is a properly chosen vector of monomials, right? And then if you can write it like that, then positive, then sum of squares is equivalent to finding such a Q under some fine conditions, which is the semi-definite program. So this was the idea of yesterday's talk, and this is the example that Pablo presented. So the whole process of giving a polynomial, deciding whether it's a sum of squares, there's a series of steps that you have to take. So you have to find all these monomials, but we abstract this to the user, and the user doesn't have to really know what's going on behind. The reason is that there is a software for it, so which accepts as inputs polynomials and spits out answers, yes or no, to questions whether that polynomials are sums of squares or not. And this software is free to download. It's called SOS Tools from these two websites. Yes?
So my question was, I think I didn't get this question.
Oh, okay. The idea is that if you have a polynomial P, right, and you're asking the question whether it's admits a sum of squares decomposition or not, right, then you can definitely write it as Z transpose QZ. So let's look at this example. You have this polynomial, right? You can write it as Z transpose QZ. And Q can be symmetric. You can always choose Q to be symmetric, right? Well, I'm going to come to that notion. What I want to right now is to explain what the ingredients are, what I'm going to be using in the next half an hour to present how this construction can be done. So this is the yes. That's true.
You're limiting the number of Lyapunov functions you are finding with sum of squares versus the total number of diagonal functions.
That's true. Yes.
Do you have any notions of, is it proof that you can, for any dynamical system, find a sum of square diagonal functions?
There's a first restriction that you haven't mentioned. I'm restricting the Lyapunov functions to be polynomials. So that's another restriction. I'm not including any other terms, although we can include them if we want, and I'll show you a method of how to include them. Now, the question that you're raising is whether there is a Lyapunov function that is positive, semi-definite, but it's not a sum of squares in both conditions, right? And I haven't come up with any such an example. I don't know if there is an example where the Lyapunov function is not only of set of measure zero in the sense that it's only a positive definite polynomial, that there's not a sum of squares, and this thing cannot find it, for example, this methodology. Yes.
So my question is, how big a restriction is it to assume that the Lyapunov functions are polynomials?
Yeah, this is a question that we don't know how to answer. So this is a question that the first steps to deciding problems is you have to make some decisions a priori. So I'm going to accept that in order to be able to answer these questions, I'm going to look at polynomials. I'm not going to be looking at other kind of Lyapunov functions.
Sure, I understand.
Yeah.
Question: do you have a sense of how big of a leap is it from all possible functions to this polynomial functions?
People know that the difference, the gap between sum of squares and positive semi-definite, in general, is small. Okay. And the two cones, the positive semi-definite cone and the sum of squares cone, touch at certain points, which is what... Yeah, Pablo.
Yeah, no, I just need to make a point. I mean, like, no, as
The bigger gap we worry about is the gap between positivity and sum of squares. We're going to polynomials are dense on compact domains, and in the end, we're always going to get compact domains. It's only to introduce things to be easier to think about. So the gap to go to polynomials is not that bad. And actually, Mike Savageau's work suggests that this recasting idea with respect to arbitrary equations and polynomials is also much more effective than we might imagine. So I think the real problem is the gap between sum of squares and positivity. But there's a gap. The gap appears to be extremely small. It's a very thin slice of functions. So for example, we don't have examples of positively optimal functions that are sum of squares. We have examples of polynomials that are positive definite. As you said, Paul said yesterday, it took 60 years from 1996 for someone to find one. And you can't, almost it's impossible to find them just sort of by random search. So, but that is at least now potentially the place where the gap is. Not so much for zero, but it seems to be extremely small. Well, I think this is right. And as the order polynomial goes up, it does shrink to a set of measure zero. But in low dimensions, it's not a set of measure zero. But it seems very small in the sense that if, as Pablo said, if you take random ensembles of polynomials, you simply never find one. And so, that might lead you to think it's a set of measure zero, but it doesn't seem to be quite a set of measure zero. So this is one of the grand unresolved questions, and in some sense, it's the heart of the gap between NP and P. If these were exactly the same, NP would equal NP. So it's this gap, which is, I think, interesting in this context. But again, you have to be careful, because in other settings, that little gap And the transform problem could get exploded up to be something quite large. So if you recast problems like 3-Sapir or the subset sum problem, you can create problems that really sit in that gap. So one way of constructing hard problems is to construct problems in other domains, map them into the polynomial. Once they're in the polynomial, small perturbations destroy that original picture. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but that's the big gap is really sum squared between sum squared positivity, and that gap in this context. In the context of dynamical systems, that gap seems to be very, very small. But in combinatoric problems that would be recast here, which is not what we're doing, that gap could appear a little larger.
Okay, so so far we have the ingredients that we are going to be using for the rest of this morning. We have the Lyapunov theorem that to assess to prove the stability of equilibria. We have the sum of squares decomposition to test these Lyapunov conditions, the positivity and the negativity of the derivative of the Lyapunov function along the system's trajectories, and we have SOS tools to do these, to formulate the semi-definite program and solve it and return the result. So what the procedure we'll be using is that we'll be proposing structures for these Lyapunov functions. So we'll be proposing monomials which would appear in it, but we will not be proposing coefficients. So we'll be searching for coefficients, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3, for these v, for example, to be a Lyapunov function for a system, right? Now, remember yesterday that even if the coefficients of certain polynomials are known, this is still a convex problem. So you can still ask the question, when is this structure positive, semi-definite, and the answer you get is a set of an alpha 1, an alpha 2, and an alpha 3 for which this is sum of squares. So instead of looking, the two conditions in the Lyapunov theorem will be casted as follows. We'll be searching for a V of this form that has parameters alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and so on, minus some positive definite function to make it positive definite. So we are constraining to be above a certain positive definite function that is required to make sure that these positive definite and not positive semi-definite, that because if we just ask for V to be sum of squares, then it's conceivable that that would be positive semi-definite, not positive definite. So making sure that it sits, that V minus something positive definite is a sum of squares, then we are constraining that to be a positive definite. And the derivative of it to be a sum of squares too. So these two conditions are going to be the sum of squares conditions that will be part of the semi-definite program that will be solved. And the result that we'll get at the end are these coefficients, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and so on. So let's look at the example. So here's a nonlinear system. X1 dot is X1, X2, and so on. And we want to investigate the stability of the equilibrium. The equilibrium is at the origin, and it's the only equilibrium for this system. So we propose this Lyapunov function. We propose this structure. We propose a quartic Lyapunov function, x1 to the fourth, x2 to the fourth, and so on. And we're searching for the coefficients, alpha 1 to alpha 5. Now, the conditions that we will write is as follows. We want v to be greater than or equal to a positive definite function. And a general positive definite function in this case is given by these. It has this form, where these epsilon 1s, epsilon 2s, epsilon 3s, and epsilon 4s are constrained to be greater. So epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 has to be greater than a positive number. That's to make sure that all the terms in x1 squared and up are positive. And the same for all the terms of x2 and up are positive. And the second condition says that minus v dot is a sum of squares. So these two conditions you can easily write down the conditions in using SOS tools, and the result you get is a Lyapunov function. And here's the resulting. So this is the phase plane as George was introduced. This is x1, the first state. This is x2, the second state. The arrows show the vector field, the black lines show the trajectories, and the blue lines show the level curve. So this is a completely algorithmic construction of a Lyapunov function. Evan, yes? Yeah, I couldn't find one. So I proposed a general quadratic Lyapunov function and tried to solve the problem, and what I got was infeasible, right? Well, then presumably not, right? What I'm looking at is polynomial Lyapunov function. This is a global one because there's only one equilibrium and it satisfies both conditions, right? I just propose, so you can propose all the monomials of order 2 to 4, right, for a Lyapunov function, and then run the program, right? And then you'll get a Lyapunov function at the end. And some of the coefficients are going to be really small. Remember that when you're solving this problem, you're solving a feasibility problem. So at the end, you're going to get a point inside the feasible set. That doesn't mean that it's an optimal point. There might be a neighborhood around it which is also feasible, right? So this is another Lyapunov function which sits around that general Lyapunov function. Yes? Yes, right now this is a polynomial vector field, but later on I'll show you examples of non-polynomial vector fields and how you can get around this problem.
So what constraints can you look at the largest degree of the proposed Lyapunov
function? So the search starts as follows. You propose a quadratic Lyapunov function and you fail to find one, right? So the next step is you increase the order of the Lyapunov function. You go for the fourth order. If the fourth order fails, then you can propose a sixth order. But if you're going higher order and you don't find Lyapunov functions, that means that then you can make assertions that either the equilibrium is unstable. If you think that the equilibrium is stable, then there's something going on with the system. This is an assertion. What you might say is that there's something wrong with the system, the model of the system, right? And I'll try to make a point where when I come to a Lyapunov function that I had a problem with. Any more questions? Okay. So this is good for polynomial vector fields. This is good for global conditions. But we want to extend it to local conditions. We want to extend it to robustness analysis when the system has a parameter in it. We want to extend it to non-polynomial vector fields. We want to extend it to rational vector fields. We want to extend it to hybrid vector fields, hybrid systems. So all these systems need new tools, and the new tools come with introducing constraint systems. So the idea is that all these types of systems with parameters, with investigating local stability, investigating stability of non-polynomial vector fields, and so on, fall into the same category: systems with constraints. Systems with equality constraints, because you might have some conserved quantities, or because of other reasons that we'll see in the next slide. Or you might have systems that have uncertain parameters in them, which is what George was introduced this morning, uncertain systems that have parametric uncertainty, right? Or you might even have systems with dynamic uncertainties, the integral quadratic constraint case. And what I want to stress again is that the uncertainty description using integral quadratic constraints is very flexible in reach and has not been, it's only been around for less than 10 years. So people are slowly starting to appreciate the use of integral quadratic constraints to do analysis. General L2, bounded uncertainty, slow varying parameters, noise, disturbances, memorialism, nonlinearities, and so on. We can all capture these as integral quadratic constraints and analyze the system. So so this is how you would proceed. So you suppose you have a system as we had before, x dot is f of x, but then now you have a bunch of constraints on it. So you have inequality constraints, equality constraints, or integral constraints. And we want to test the stability of this system, right? A system with constraints. The way you would attack this problem is by adjoining these constraints to the Lyapunov conditions in the same way that you join constraints when you try to find Lagrangians for constrained optimization problems, in the same way that control engineers use the S procedure to test a bunch of conditions when one other condition is satisfied. In the same way that positive Stellensatz puts all these series of constraints and asks whether a set is empty. All these things are interrelated, and the idea here is that instead of adjoining inequality constraints with constants as you would do in general, we can adjoin these constraints with sums of squares, with positive polynomials instead of constants. We can adjoin equality constraints instead of with constants that are not constrained to be positive anymore. We can adjoin them using polynomials, general polynomials, and we do here as we do here in the second Lyapunov condition. And integral constraint constraints can be adjoined. The kernels of them can be adjoined using constants. So this is the framework that we'll be using in for the rest of today. Constraints, well, adjoin them to the conditions using corresponding multipliers. And when you do that with constants, there's conservatism here. When you do that with constants, there's a conservatism. When you do that with polynomials, there is at least, at worst case, the same conservatism. Usually, strictly better. You get strictly better results. And we'll see that in the case of hybrid systems, that adjoining them, the constraints using higher order multipliers and so on, you get better conditions. So the way now you would formulate, for example, robustness is totally clear. You would define a parametric set that where the parameters live in by inequalities, by integral quadratic constraints, and so on. And then when you have a description of the parametric set, when you have a description of this space you will be looking for stability, then the problem from being completely a biological issue of assessing robust stability of this system ends up being testing whether a bunch of whether a system with certain constraints can ever have an equilibrium that is stable. So to check, for example, to check robust stability for a system would be constructing Lyapunov functions that now are parametrized by these parameters, these new parameters that are in the system and are uncertain. And in doing so, every Lyapunov function for every set of that parameters is every function that every point in that parametric set for every point in the parametric set, the polynomial that you get at the end is a Lyapunov function. So let's have a look at the problem that Joe introduced yesterday, which is robust analysis for a simple chemical oscillator. So here you have a very simple trimolecular reaction. And the first step, of course, is to write down the equations, the evolution equations. And then when you non-dimensionalize the equations, you end up with these two very simple equations. Now, these equations have two parameters, A and B, that depend on the concentrations of these reactants. And the question you'd be asking is whether the equilibrium of this system is stable. Now, if you do linear analysis for this system, you find that in this red region, which defines this is the parameter set A and B, in this red region, the equilibrium is unstable. Okay, so what we'll be doing is we'll be constructing Lyapunov functions for parts of the rest of the region, namely these colored parts, to prove stability of every system that sits inside that region. So if I choose, for example, A and B to be 1-1, that defines a system here, right? But I have a Lyapunov function that is parameterized already by A and B. So just plugging in 1-1 to that Lyapunov function will give me the Lyapunov function. This is the way you prove robust stability of a system. So The notice now that how the constraints are going to come in. First of all, we said that we want the Lyapunov function, we want the equilibrium to be at the origin. So we have to shift the equilibrium of this system, which is not at the origin, to the origin. And then, well, you have to make sure that the origin is actually an equilibrium of this system, because as A and B move around, the origin moves. So first of all, we move the equilibrium to the origin. Yes? A and B? Yes, they're constants, but they're parameters. So you don't know them. You know they live in some. So they're not dynamic. They don't change with time.
I don't understand what that means.
So that means that you want to check whether a set of systems is stable, not just one. And yeah, but the concentration of A. See, the concentration of A might be changing, right?
Okay, so this is like we have some chemical reaction, we're measuring A, and if it goes down, we add more constant.
Yeah, A and B are external inputs that are held constant. Okay? Obviously, to have an oscillator, you have to have a driven, externally driven system, right? It's not a thing. So A and B, chemically, what's going on is A and B are external constants stuff that you're gripping in or you're moving or taking it out of A and B. It's really just a toy problem, but yeah, those are held constant. They could be time varying, but we're assuming that you have an experimental apparatus whereby you're holding those constants. But it does mean that there would be a flux of A and B in or out of the system in order to keep those concentrations constant.
Isn't the idea of, wouldn't this be reaching a limit cycle more than?
No, this is an equilibrium point. It's a focal equilibrium point.
In the red region, it goes.
In the red region, you get the equilibrium goes unstable, and you get a stable limit cycle around it.
Oh, so unstable.
So it goes an unstable equilibrium. You get say the equilibrium here is a focus, right?
In terms of, for example, just this chemical system, is the most interesting part in the red region?
No, you want to avoid oscillations. Well, we want to prove, for example, I want to prove to you that for any parameters in these region outside, then you don't get a limit cycle, right? Which is a question that is very difficult to answer using simulation, for example. You have to simulate the system for every parameter set in this system. And even then, you wouldn't be convinced 100% that, yeah, there's no limit cycle there.
Let me see what you're asking now. Let's suppose in that red region, what you can check is that those equilibrium are unstable.
Yeah,
right?
Like a constant.
But what you'd like to do is prove in the red region that you actually go to a limit cycle, or in a higher dimension, you might go to the tracker or so we're working, that involves much more complicated machinery because the description of the attractor, it has to be described somehow correctly. And so we're working on that.
Essentially, that seems like more constraining, for example, say you're trying to constrain a biological model. It seems like.
Well, most of the time you want to prove that something is stable, doesn't want to fight. But this machinery, at least in principle, would allow us to prove that the red region went to a limit cycle. But that's not what we're going to do today. And first of all, that isn't done, is it?
Nay.
Okay. I mean, it's hard to get, every day it changes, so that isn't done yet.
Closed, but
you can imagine that a limit cycle could be a semi-algebraic set or approximated by semi-algebraic set, and you could try to say that you stay in the vicinity of that and prove that you do using the same machinery. Because sort of these barrier functions can do that. But we haven't extended to that question yet. But you're right, those are interesting. I don't think they're as biologically interesting. Maybe they are in some circumstances.
Well, I mean, just even if you're saying, I'm a cell, I'm growing, there's not going to be many points where you're sitting there at a stable point.
That's another point, which is that these equilibria don't have to be fixed. Here, they're moving around, right? But you could ask that you stay on top of the trajectory. So airplanes, right? I mean, you take off, you land, and so you really want to be about trajectory. But in that case, the trajectory is externally described. So there's a growth pattern that you want, or something that you want to fly a flight pattern. That's no problem. That should give you a time-varying consideration. So It's when the dynamics create a limit cycle of an unknown character that you want to explore, and that's hard, especially if it's chaotic. Then you might have an attractor. Clearly, a cap attractor is going to be some element, right? And how would you describe it? That's one thing you're looking at. But the case of growth and those kinds of problems, that's not too hard to deal with, because all you're doing is you're changing the equilibrium of the problem. Here, we're just changing the equilibrium with a fixed parameter. But you're right, those are all interesting questions, and that the stuff extends to up to a point. But there is a point at which it's still research and we still have time. Well, systems can be state. Linear instability tells you about an infinitesimal region around the equilibrium. It gives you some neighborhood of the orient.
Yeah.
We're not interested in this neighborhood. We're interested in far from equilibrium. If you start far from equilibrium, but yeah, you're right. If you just care about infinitesimal perturbations around the nominal, fine. Linear stability is fine. And that's what linear stability tells you. The conjecture you get from this, oh, maybe I'm stable in a larger region.
So, and the way you do that is here the first thing we did was to translate the equilibrium to the origin, but then the equilibrium has to be at the origin, or it has to satisfy itself some equality constraints. So these are the first type of constraints that we get. So the equilibrium here is U3, U4, and it has to satisfy these two when U1 and U2, which are the A and B changes. And then you have inequality constraints that arise from perhaps you want to restrict this region of the state space, and for such a system this is reasonable because concentrations have to be always positive. For example, it doesn't make sense to look at parts of the state space that correspond to negative concentrations. And of course, the most important thing that we're using in machinery is to describe the uncertainty. So you want to test whether certain parts of the uncertainty are the parametric uncertainty prove stability of the system. So you describe your system using a bunch of inequality constraints, equality constraints, and then you join them in the sort of manner that I explained in the theorem. And what you get at the end is two Lyapunov functions. So one Lyapunov function we got was in this region, and the other Lyapunov function was in this region, right? And here are the level curves for two points in the two different regions. So this is completely algorithmic and depends on the problem that how you construct. Now this is very similar to the robustness analysis of the heat shock in E. coli. So the system here is three dimensional. Although the third state evolves much faster than the other one and can be approximated, so the system becomes a DAE, two states and an inequality constraint, and then the same machinery this is the system that Hannah described yesterday. The same machinery you can use to find the Lyapunov function for certain parts of the parameter space. Here, eta and alpha s are the two parameters. So eta is the feed forward control. It's a parameter dependent, temperature dependent function. So you see here that the equilibrium moves as you change the parameters and so on. So this is sort of standard right now how you do these analyses for parametric uncertainty. So the next thing I want to say before we break is this issue of non-polynomial vector fields and what you do with them. What you can do with them is, well, you can recast, in certain cases, you can recast the system in a certain way so that it becomes polynomial. And that introduces certain inequality or equality constraints. But then the bonus is that now they have a new description of the system. It's completely polynomial, higher order perhaps, higher dimension. But then the bonus is that you can search over the new parameters, which are non-polynomial, which are describe non-polynomial terms, so you can construct non-polynomial Lyapunov functions. So here is an example of how you can do that. This is a very simple example. It involves this, it's x1 dot is x2, x2 dot is minus phi of x1 plus x2. Phi is a saturation function, which has this form. So this is phi. It has sigma of a square root of 1 plus sigma squared. And there's some notion that this is a characteristic function, actually, and we expect these terms, square root of 1 plus sigma squared, where sigma in this case is just x1, to appear in the Lyapunov function. We have some intuition about that, and there's some theory behind it. So here, what you can do is get your system that was non-polynomial to start off with. It included square roots. It might include sines, cosines, exponentials, and recast it as a polynomial. And the way you do it is you introduce the new variables, u1, u2, u3, u4, where u1 is this square root that appears in the denominator. U2 is just the inverse of that. U3 is that square root that we expect to appear in the Lyapunov function. And u4 is the inverse of that. And then you can write down the system description. Now it becomes six-dimensional. And you have a bunch of equality constraints saying that u1, u2 is 1, u3 squared is 1 plus x1 squared, and there's another one missing, I think. So there should be one saying that u1 squared equals 1 plus x1 squared plus x2 squared. So when you have this description of the system, then it falls exactly in the framework of the theorem. You kind of join all these constraints to the Lyapunov conditions and transfer a Lyapunov function. And we propose this Lyapunov function, which has u3 in it, which is was the non-polynomial term. And the procedure after that is completely straightforward. There's, yes? But it's a radical too, right? Yeah, I have an example later on to show you how you do sines and cosines. So there, your constraint will be a trigonometric constraint of the form sine squared plus cos squared is 1. So this u I have to pick because there's a square root. I have to render this vector field polynomial,
sure.
Right? There's no experience to picking u1 because you have to do it to get it polynomial. The experience comes picking u3, right? Because I expect that to come in the Lyapunov function.
What kind of constraint is on the map on the axis
we use? You have to. So these constraints that the uis are positive, it make sure that they accommodate for that, for the map to be a diffeo. So what you do then is just turn the handle, and you get this Lyapunov function, and the Lyapunov function it has u3 in, which was that square root, and here is the Lyapunov function for the system. So it's non-polynomial. Now I've been asked about sines and cosines, and I just have a couple of minutes. I can quickly touch on this system. So this is a system. This is a whirling pendulum. It's a completely mechanical system. Suppose you're holding this bar, and this is a rigid bar, right? And at the tip of that, there's a pendulum, right? And then you're swirling the middle bar like that. So the pendulum can swing in the normal plane to LA, right? So as you swing it with a certain velocity, the pendulum keeps. It stays down, but as you increase the velocity, the angular velocity, you're swirling the pendulum. At some point, the pendulum is going to swing away, right? You get a bifurcation. This is the description of the system. The states here are the angular position of the pendulum and its angular velocity. So here's what I was just saying, is that when the angular rotation of the handle is less than g over lp, then the only equilibrium is the vertically upwards and the vertically downwards. But when you increase theta alpha dot squared beyond this value, then you get two more equilibrium, so you get a pitchfork bifurcation. And that's when the equilibrium, this equilibrium becomes unstable, and the pendulum swings to another equilibrium. So what you do here is to render this thing polynomial is you introduce variables sine and cos, right? And then you rewrite the vector field as a polynomial vector field. And then from then on, you can use the machinery and construct Lyapunov functions. You expect certain trigonometric terms to appear because you know that the energy involves trigonometric terms. Remember that all these Lyapunov functions have some energy behind them, and if you are dealing with a system that has some physical meaning, then you expect these terms to appear. Then you should try to cast the system so that you try to find them. So here we're looking at the Lyapunov function that is completely this non-polynomial. It has these sine square terms, cos x1 terms, and so on. And then you get this Lyapunov function here. And of course you can consider theta alpha dot as a parameter to the system, and then try to see how far can you get the Lyapunov function to be a Lyapunov function to be a Lyapunov function, so that you can prove that for all theta alpha dot less than g over L alpha, the bifurcation point, the system, the equilibrium is stable. And indeed, what you find is this Lyapunov function here that involves theta alpha dot as a parameter, which by simple analysis you can show that stops being positive definite when theta alpha dot squared is less than 10. Yes. So you have. Okay. What you have to give the software is first of all you have to write down the conditions, right? So you have to say, I propose this Lyapunov function, I propose the shape, I propose what terms, what monomials are going to appear, and then the software will tell you for these terms that you chose whether there is one or not. There is a sum of squares and satisfies this condition. Okay. So in this case, this is how we attack the problem of sines and cosines. An exponential. So there is a catch. You cannot not always do that. You cannot always do this polynomial so that you can transform it into another vector field and not get new things appearing. For example, if I had the angle x1 appearing here, then this transformation would be trickier, right? But in certain other cases, you can definitely do it. So, are we breaking now? What's the schedule?
So let me just make one comment about this. So this is a lot of stuff that we still don't entirely understand. First of all, one thing to notice is how little conservatism there is in this. So you really nail the point at which the bifurcation occurs. That wouldn't always happen. So are you going to show later this example where, you know, if you try to push this up to, you know, 10 nines or something, you hire really often, right?
Yeah, that's
at that point, notice this fragility starts coming in, right? Because you're saying, I'm proving it's up to stable up this bifurcation point, but if I change the parameter of the problem, I'm actually going to a region where it's unstable. So the other thing is, all computers can actually compute are, you know, additions and multiplications.
So we write down things like sines and cosines, but when we actually even simulate such things, you either do a power series or something, right? And so there's a couple ways of thinking about this. One of it is that what we're doing here is embedding these problems in a higher dimensional space, in which they are then a manifold on which the trajectories evolve. And there's a lot of reasons to believe that that's actually, in a bunch of ways, a better representation of the system. These compressed forms, where you imagine that you've got, it's simpler for us to look at them, right? It's simpler for us to look at a system that says sine of x, right? But computationally, sine of x has to be redone in terms of additions and multiplications and divisions. You can't just compute sine of x. There's no. You have to do that. So there's some reason to believe, and Mike Savage has got a lot of interesting ideas and a lot of experience with this in the context of biochemical problems, that this recasting, embedding the system in a larger, higher dimensional system is numerically better, and it's better for a whole lot of computational reasons that we still don't yet understand. But there's reason to believe that if you're going to hand something off to a computer, you're going to do inference about it. It's actually better to put it in this ambient space on which you're employing a lot of manifold than to collapse things down in this manifold where things are could be intrinsically open condition. But this is something we still don't have as deep an understanding of as we'd like. That's one of the topics we'll talk about tomorrow when we get into the sort of, those of you who want to stick around, is the mathematics of that question. And where, because that's a couple of things we're going to talk about. That's definitely what we're going to do tomorrow for those of you who want to try to come and see that tomorrow. So one of the topics we're going to have is talk with Mike about this issue of embedding these problems in these higher dimensions. And a lot of times, they start with higher dimensions anyway, right? A lot of times we start with high dimension differential algebraic equations and collapse them down by solving. That's often usually a bad thing to do. Because the stuff you do by hand might introduce errors. You're often better to leave things in the more natural coordinates, which are high dimensional and so are described implicitly. And so there's a lot of reason to believe that the implicit description, these implicit descriptions of a bunch of inequalities or equalities, is better than solving those things and then stuffing them into the equations. That can introduce ill conditioning. Let the computer do that. And there's a lot of reasons to believe that in some sense these embedded systems are both more natural and much better condition. And so, but that's an unresolved edge of this research. So any questions before we break? Yeah. There's a trivial bit that sort of possibly misleading answer is that, again, compact domains and polynomials are dense. So in some sense, you can get arbitrarily close just by general consideration. Right? But the question is, can you get an exact recasting in the higher dimension? And then that question is essentially what functions are embedded semi-algebraic. And so I don't actually know what the status of that research question is.
I mean, there are things that clearly cannot be embedded.
Yeah. So there's some kinds of transcendentals that are going to have to get you a problem. And then you have to approximate them a problem. So this is one of the interesting research questions, is what set of, it's kind of even amazing that we're thinking about asking a question like that, which is, you know, what are the full class of nonlinearities that we can do this with? Because it's, but it is an actual question to ask at this point. So, well, because I mean, like, you know, a couple of years ago, we would have said, like, why in the world would you care about all that? You can't even solve polynomial problems. right? So the fact, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know how the questions shifted, like, tremendously. But these are now where this is now where the edge is what kinds of things that the recast is like. And it is interesting. It is interesting that Mike has had a lot of experience in doing this, and so he's been looking at this for some time. So again, he's way out ahead of us in terms of working on these problems for some time and having a lot of intuition, a lot of experience with them. So we're going to try to take advantage of his experience and his intuition and guide this next round of research. Yeah.
And you have mostly examples. You look at second case, the last question, and I, yeah. And my question is more related to that. The division of the phase space you mentioned.
Chopped up, yeah.
I mean, that anti-dynamics desire effect make a lot. But then the question then, I mean, sometimes you have a different desire of region where you already know the desire of region is stable. And the question there is not an economic or a function, but what regions can I ask that question?
Yeah, we're going to do more of that later?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to do more of that later. So
after the break.
Let's take a break now. We'll come back at 11.